Wearing a heavy suit has been a common thing. I grew up in Texas harvesting things in the cotton field, and one of the suits that I wore was a pair of blue jeans and a heavy khaki shirt and then a straw hat. And you worked when it was 70, 80, 90 degrees, and I didn't go bare-chested because you might get blistered, but if you had a khaki, heavy khaki shirt, you were okay. But the real thing is where I learned to get by on this. First pastorate in Phoenix, Arizona in 1961, I guess it was, I had bought a very heavy black wool suit in California. Why, I don't know, but that's all the money I had, and that's the only suit they had. But anyway, when we moved over to Arizona in Phoenix, and it was in the summertime, then I wore that suit, and it was a heavy black wool suit, and when it was 70, 80, 90 degrees, I still wore that because I had one other, I think, two others, but this was the main suit, and it was kind of like people expected you wear the preacher's suit. You know, they all wear a black suit. Well, it's the only black suit I had, and so I did wear that, and I just got in the habit of it. It didn't bother me that much because I, as I said, learned how to withstand the heat in Texas working in the cotton fields. I don't know how that fixes, I don't know how that helps you to understand the Sabbath anymore, but at least you'll know that why I sometimes can wear a heavy suit when you think he must be dying. Okay. The subject I want to talk about today is about guilt. And guilt is not a female pig without maybe you don't even know that. You know, they have the sow and then they have the guilt. And the sow pig has had guilts. The sow pig has given babies, but the guilt has never had any babies. So, and I, before I knew the truth, I raised pigs, and I had one that won a contest over all the males, and it was a guilt, a female. There again, I'm getting off track very early. But what I said was, I want to talk about today guilt. I know you understand that. We all understand that. We may have suffered from that and may even be suffering from it today. Who knows? Do you ever allow your thoughts to sabotage your Christian attitude toward life? You think, no, I'd never do that. But after I ask that question, you may also say to yourself, well, be more specific. I'd like to know what you're talking about. Okay, do you ever feel guilty? Have you ever felt guilty? Are you feeling guilty even today? Do you have prolonged bouts of guilt? And especially, are you justified in your feelings of guilt? Some say, yeah, I am. They deserved it. Are you justified in a prolonged period of guilt? Some may ask the question, well, what is guilt? Is guilt the result of having committed a breach of conduct, such as violates law and involves a penalty? Is that why you'd be guilty? Or is it because you're not guilty, but you think you're guilty? And people do that too, and they suffer from, they're not sure they're guilty, but they think maybe they are. Whether it's for real or whether you just think you are, it has the same effects, and they can be disastrous. And it is disastrous for a Christian. Obviously, guilt is connected to the word guilty. Guilt is connected to the word guilty. Sometimes we're guilty. Sometimes we think we're guilty. But guilt is a sense of shame at personal wrongdoing. And that can destroy even a Christian. Guilt implies being responsible for an offense or a wrongdoing. And it's because one has done something that was forbidden, or they also may have failed to do something that was required, and they're feeling guilty over that. And the source could be religious, legal, social, or personal, and usually the personal is the worst. So, as I said before, guilt can be real or it can be imagined. You did something or you didn't do something. Either way, guilt because we are guilty or guilt because we think we're guilty has a devastating effect on our emotional system, and we all have an emotional system. So let me ask the question again. Do you ever allow your thoughts to destroy your positive Christian attitude toward life? I'm sure you have. I have. It seems to be something that we all run into from time to time. So today, I'd like to look at the causes of guilt and how to deal with it. In the Bible, guilt is connected with sin, the breaking of God's laws. Sin can mean to miss the mark, and in that sense, we all suffer from guilt, especially the guilt of omitting to do things. But true guilt is connected with real sin. Let's notice this in Leviticus 5, and we'll read the first four verses. The book of Leviticus, chapter 5, and the first four, maybe five, of the verses. If a person sins, and we might not think this is sin the way it's written here, but it can be. If a person sins in hearing the utterance of an oath and is a witness, whether he's seen or known of the matter, if he does not tell it, he bears guilt. He has not done what he should have done, and he's guilty. Then verse 2 says, or if a person touches any unclean thing, and this was in the Old Testament where they were not allowed to do certain things like that. Obviously, if you're riding a horse and you pat the horse's nose, the horse is an unclean animal as far as eating is concerned, so you wouldn't be guilty there. But this is talking about in the days of Israel and clean and unclean things. If a person touches any unclean thing, whether it's in the carcass of an unclean beast or the carcass of an unclean livestock or the carcass of unclean creeping things, and he is unaware of it, he also shall be unclean and guilty. Notice I said guilt is tied in with guilty. A third one listed in verse 3, or if he touches human uncleanness, whatever uncleanness with which a man may be defiled. And it doesn't. You know, the Bible talks about a lot of things, but sometimes it doesn't go into lurid details as we as humans always do. It just said, if he touches human uncleanness, whatever uncleanness with which a man may be defiled, and he's unaware of it, when he realizes it, he shall be guilty. He has the guilt on him of doing something he should not have done. Then verse 4, or if a person swears, speaking thoughtlessly with his lips, which is a common thing for human beings, to do evil or to do good, you know, he swore, whatever it is that a man may pronounce by an oath, and he's unaware of it, when he realizes it, then, and as we say, when he comes to himself and realizes what he did, then he shall be guilty in any of these matters. Guilt, quite often, is connected with sin, real sin, the breaking of a law or the breaking of some principle of God that should not have been broken. I'd like to read just a little bit from an example in the Old Testament, and you're all quite well acquainted with this, of the sons of Israel and what they did to their brother Joseph. There is that story in Genesis 42, and it's a little humorous in one sense, although it's horrible when you read about the reality of it, what they did to their brother Joseph. So let's go to Genesis 42, and we'll start in verse 5, going along with the idea of having done something that was wrong and of feeling guilty for it and the things they do because they feel guilty and how to get rid of the guilt. Genesis 42 and verse 5, I believe we'll start with that. As I said, the things that went on before this, what I wanted to talk about, let's go to verse 1 first just to show the story flow. Jacob saw there was no grain in Egypt, and he said, "Why are you looking at each other? I've heard there's grain in Egypt, so go there and buy us some that we may live and not die." So the Joseph's 10 brothers went down to buy grain in Egypt. Now, Joseph was already there, but they didn't know that. Jacob did not send Joseph's brother Benjamin with his brothers because he said, lest some calamity befall him. So they went down to buy, and the famine was heavy in the land of Canaan. And then it inserts the thought here that Joseph was governor over the land. And it was he who sold to all the people of the land. Joseph's brothers came and bowed down and with their faces to the earth. And then Joseph realized these were his brothers. And he recognized them, but he acted like he didn't. And he spoke roughly to them. That's family, you know. Then he said to them, "Where'd he come from?" They said, "The land of Canaan to buy food." Well, it says again, he recognized his brothers, but they didn't recognize him. So Joseph remembered the dream which he had dreamed about and said to them, you know, he said, "You're all going to bow down to me." And they got mad at him. He said, "You're spies. You've come here to see the nakedness of the land." They said, "No." And they called him because they didn't know it was Joseph. They thought it was, shall we say, the king of a man of great authority. They said, "No, my lord, but your servants, we come to buy food. We're all one man's sons. We're honest men. Your servants are not spies." But he said, "No, you've come here to see the nakedness of the land." And they said, "Your servants are 12 brothers, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. And in fact, the youngest is with our father today, and one is no more." Or at least they thought there was no more because they'd sent him away to Egypt with the Muslims at that time, I believe it was. And that's the last they ever saw of him. And they even put blood on a garment, sent it back to their father and said, "Your son is dead. Here's the evidence." So they sold their brother. They lied about his death. And then when they went to Egypt to buy corn, who do you think they ran into first? The brother they thought they'd gotten rid of. Joseph said, "It's like I told you, you're spies. In this manner, then, you're going to be tested. By the life of Pharaoh, you shall not leave this place unless your youngest brother comes here." Well, that hit him pretty hard because they didn't even know where he was. "Send one of you and let him bring your brother, and you'll be kept in prison, that your words may be tested to see whether there's any truth in you. Or else, by the life of Pharaoh, surely you are spies." Getting deeper all the time here. So they put him all together in prison 3 days. Joseph said to them on the third day, "Do this and live, for I fear God. If you're honest men, let one of your brothers be confined to your prison house, but you go and carry grain for the famine of the houses, and bring your youngest brother to me so that your words will be verified and you won't die." And they did so. And notice in verse 21, they said to one another, now they got out of hearing distance, they started talking to each other, and they said, "We're truly guilty." And they were feeling guilt also over it. "We truly are guilty concerning our brother. We saw the anguish of his life when he pleaded with us and we wouldn't listen to him. Therefore, this distress has come on us." Reuben answered and said, now Reuben was the firstborn, Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. Reuben answered and said, "Did I not speak to you saying, don't sin against the boy? And you wouldn't listen to me. Therefore, his blood is now required of us. But they didn't know that Joseph, the one they got rid of, was standing there listening to every word they were saying. That always gets people. You don't know that they know your language and they're listening to everything you said. They didn't know that Joseph understood them, for he spoke to them through an interpreter. Well, Joseph turned away from them and wept because he was now second in command in Egypt. He had a good life. He knew that God had worked with him and God had blessed him. And here he saw his brothers who had sent him away and who, as far as they were concerned, they got rid of him. He may have died. They didn't know where he was. So then he turned to them again and talked with them. He took Simeon from them and bound him before their eyes. And let's see, you will find in, well, I don't read the rest of it because he's talking about where he deliberately put money into sacks and sent away it. Then he sent someone to catch them and find that they had stolen the grain and had stolen some money. And they all denied that. Let's see. Yes. It was obvious in any case, the way they were talking to each other, that they knew they were guilty and they felt very bad about it. And in truth, they really did have a real reason for feeling guilty. But I want to go on to another point right now before we get to the one that really gets to you when you read what he said after knowing that he was guilty and after knowing that he might lose his other brother too. What's the best policy if you truly are guilty? There is a way to get rid of the guilt. If you believe you are guilty, or if you think you're guilty, or if someone has accused you of being guilty, if you're suffering from guilt, what's the best way to get rid of that guilt? What if you're caught red-handed? Jim Hopkins and I were talking about that one day, and he said, what do you do when your wife catches you red-handed about something, and you know she's right, and you know you're wrong, but what do you do? I said, Jim, I don't know. He said, yell louder. Well, that's what many do to get rid of the guilt. They yell louder. They try to plow over the top of you and dominate it. No, there's a better way, and it is the godly way. You'll find it beginning in Genesis 44. The way to get rid of guilt is you fess up. Then you don't have anything to feel guilty about. Genesis 44, let's begin in verse 14. Genesis 44 and verse 13. Oh, wait a minute, just a minute. Genesis 44, verse 14, sorry. This is where they had taken the sacks with money in them and they got caught. Deliberately, Joseph had done that. And they knew they were in real trouble. Because when they were found, they realized he began searching with them, and he began with the oldest and left off with the youngest. And the cup that had been stolen was found in Benjamin's sack, and Benjamin was the baby boy, and he'd been told, if you don't bring him back, you're in trouble. So Verse 13, when they were caught, they tore their clothes, and each man loaded his donkey and returned to the city. So Judah and his brothers came to Joseph's house, and he was still there, and they fell before him on the ground. Now, he had prophesied that many years ago, and they hated him because he had said that. Joseph said, "What deed is this you've done? Didn't you know that such a man as I can certainly practice divination, foretelling certain things?" And then Judah stepped up, and I believe it was Judah who said, "Didn't I tell you, don't do that?" Judah said, "What shall we say to my Lord?" So now he was calling him my Lord. "What shall we speak, or how shall we clear ourselves?" They knew they needed to get rid of the feeling of guilt because they knew they were guilty. "How shall we clear ourselves? God has found out the iniquity of your servants." Now they were telling him they were his servants. "God's found out the iniquity of your servants here. Here we are, my Lord, slaves to you, both we and he also with whom the cup was found." But he said, "Far be it from," this is Joseph, "far be it from me that I should do so. The man in whose hand the cup was found, he shall be my slave. And as for you, go up in peace to your father." And this is where then Judah really comes apart emotionally. Judah came near to him and said, "Please let your servant speak a word in my Lord's hearing. And do not let your anger burn against your servant, for you're like Pharaoh. My Lord asked his servant, saying, 'Have you a father or a brother?' And we said, 'We have a father, he's an old man, and a child of his old age who is young. His brother's dead.'" They thought he was dead. Now they're talking to him, don't know who he is. "He's alone. He alone is left of his mother's children, and his father loves him." And he did show partiality to Joseph. "Then you said to your servants, 'Bring him down to me that I may set my eyes on him.' And we said to my Lord, 'The lad can't leave his father, for if he leaves his father would die.' But you've said to us, 'Unless that you bring that younger brother, you'll see my face no more.' So it was when we went up to see your servant, my father, that we told him the words of your what you said. And our father said, 'Go back and buy us a little food.' But we said, 'We can't. We can't go down. If our youngest brother is with us, then we will go down, for if we may not see the man's face unless our younger brother's with us.' Then your servant," he's calling himself the servant, "his father, your servant, my father, said to us, 'You know that my wife bore me two sons, and the one went out from me, and I said, surely he's torn of places, and I've not seen him since. But if you take this one from me, and calamity befalls him, you will bring down on my gray hair with sorrow to the grave.'" So they realized they had put their father in a bad situation. "Now, therefore, when I come to your servant, my father, and the lad is not with us, since his life is bound up in the lad's life, it will happen when he sees that the lad is not with us, he'll die. So your servants will bring down the gray hair of your father, your servant, our father, with sorrow to the grave. For your servant became surety for the lad to my father, saying, 'If you don't bring him back, then I shall bear the shame before my father forever. Now, therefore, please, please let your servant remain instead of the lad.'" He was willing to be a slave to the leader of Egypt than to get his own way. I'm sure it hurt him greatly. He felt very guilty about what had happened. "Let your servant remain instead of the lad as a slave to my Lord, and let the lad go up with his brothers. For how shall I go to my father if the lad is not with me, lest perhaps I see the evil that would come upon my father?" Well, that's when Joseph came apart. He couldn't refrain from crying. He was moved very, very much. But Judah fessed up. He told him the whole story. He admitted they had what they had done. I don't know if he gave them everything about it, but they admitted what they'd done, and they realized they were wrong. And now, through circumstances beyond their control, Judah was forced to fess up. So you find in chapter 45, verse 1, Joseph couldn't restrain himself before all those who stood by him. And he said, "Get out." No one stood with him while Joseph made himself known to his brothers. And if you've been in a family and you've hurt your brother or sister and you were in a situation, I probably cried too when you realized the damage that had been done. But the point is, how do you get rid of the guilt? You fess up. That's the only logical way. Either you fess up if you don't know the true God to the ones you've hurt, or if it is God is involved in it, then you ask God to forgive you for what you've done that you know is wrong. Admit it. Admit the wrong and ask for forgiveness. Let's look in Psalm 38 and verse 4, where you find this about guilt. Psalm 38. And verse 4. Psalm 38, verse 4 says, I think here again we have to read some of the verses just in front of us. Verse 1 says, "Don't rebuke me in your wrath." Verse 3, "There's no soundness in my flesh, health in my bones, because of my sin." And then in verse 4, "My iniquities have gone over my head like a heavy burden. They are too heavy for me." There it calls guilt because of sin, wrongdoing, a very heavy burden, too heavy for him. He said, "My wounds are foul and festering because of my foolishness." Unresolved guilt can have a very paralyzing effect on people, on a person. But forgiveness brings about the release of that pent-up emotional difficulty, the feelings of guilt, because you admitted it, it's over and done with, you don't plan to do it anymore, so you don't have to feel guilty over it. You still know that it was done. You can't forgive, you can't get rid of it yourself, and you can't ever forget it. But at least you told the truth and relented yourself of all of that guilt feeling. Let's look in Psalm 32, where it says this. Psalm 32 and verse 1. "Blessed is the individual whose transgression or guilt is forgiven, whose sin is covered," obviously, of God. Verse 3 says, "When I kept silence," in other words, when he did not admit his wrong, "my bones grew old through my groaning all the day long. For day and night your hand was heavy upon me. My vitality was turned into the drought of summer." Then he said, "I acknowledged my sin," or as I use the term, fessed up. Finally fessed up, admitted what he had done, and maybe even why, to God. "I acknowledged my sin to you, and my iniquity I have not hidden. I said, I will confess my transgression to God, and you forgave the iniquity of my sin." That's the only good way to get rid of guilt. And if we don't, then we really do have a problem. The answer is to confess it. In 1 John 1, verse 9. This is the aged apostle, John. To my knowledge, the others were all dead. And John had this to say about life when you've done things wrong. John, 1 John 1, verse 9 says, if we confess our sins, and I'm sure he learned that the hard way too, he was human. If we confess our sins, he is faithful and just, he meaning God, to forgive us of our sins and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. Let's go to, and how can we know that that's sure? Let's go to Leviticus 5 and verse 5, right after the first four verses I read to begin with. I deliberately did not read verse 5 because it tied into this. Leviticus chapter 5 and verse 5. After doing all those things and you are guilty and there is guilt there, then it says in verse 5, if we can get there, chapter 5 and verse 5, the first four verses talked about doing certain things and being guilty or having guilt. So verse 5 says, it shall be when he is guilty in any of these matters, that he or she, whoever, if he shall confess that he has sinned in that thing, or admit it, then he's to bring a certain, and this was the days of the offerings, he's to bring such and such, and showing that God would forgive what was done. That's the only logical answer. The incident of the sons of Israel, who knew what they had done, knew why they did it, and had a horrible guilt in their lives because of it. The incident of the sons of Israel shows that supposed or assumed guilt has some effect. Parents, church, friends can put a guilt trip on you, but don't let it happen. Guilt can be real or imagined, and it is because of God's laws that we have broken that we have this. So what do you do if you really weren't guilty? And how do you deal, and yet you feel like you have? And this is the part sometimes that gives us more trouble than the other. You're not truly guilty, but somehow you feel you are. Let's look in 1 John 3 this time and see what God inspired to be said about that situation. 1 John 3 and verse 19. It is said that we're to love in word. We're to love not just in word or tongue, but in deed and truth. And then 19 says, and by this we know that we are of the truth and we'll assure our hearts before God. That is, we won't have any guilt. We will be assured. Then it said, for if our heart condemns us, and it will, God is greater than our heart and knows all things. So you, if you feel you're guilty when you're really not, you need to talk to God about it. But if it says, if our heart doesn't condemn us, we have confidence toward God. I'd like to read in Exodus 25. Perhaps you've read this, but it was part of the Old Testament covenant, the Old Testament way of doing things. And sometimes you can read all these things that have wonderful meaning and just gloss right over it because, well, just because it was that way. Exodus 25 And we'll start in verse 16. Exodus 25 and verse 16. And it has to do with, how do you know God is going to forgive you? Exodus 25, beginning in verse 16. This is talking about all the different things that go with the Old Testament sanctuary, where God was going to build this sanctuary, and the sanctuary was where he would dwell among them. And he said, according to all that I show you, that is the pattern of the tabernacle and the pattern of its furnishings, just so you shall make it. And then he talks about the ark. But coming down to verse 16, you're to put in the ark the testimony, meaning the laws of God, the Ten Commandments. So anytime you go before God, and this is the truth that was being spoken, but that's in Old Testament language, and it doesn't hit our brain as it should. There is this ark, there is the laws there. And then it said in verse 17, because, and this is right above the testimony, you shall make a mercy seat of pure gold. Wasn't out of pressed wood, but of pure gold. And it lists it as cherubim there. And then in verse 21, you shall put the mercy seat on top of the ark. So we have the ark, we have the laws in the ark, and then we have on top of that the mercy seat. So this shows that when we come before God, we will always have to face God's law. No exception. We will always have to face God's law, and sometimes we're right and sometimes we're wrong. Sometimes we've not done anything wrong, and sometimes there is. But on top of the law, then, is this mercy seat. We know what mercy is. God is a merciful God. You're to put the ark, verse 21, you're to put the mercy seat on top of the ark. And then in verse 22, God says to his people, to anyone who knows who God is, and there, where? The mercy seat. I will meet with you. That's an absolute promise God made to those who have committed wrong and feel guilty about it. There I will meet with you, and I will speak with you from above the mercy seat, from between the two cherubim that are in the ark, or on the ark, after everything, or about everything which I will give you in commandment to the children of Israel. God is a merciful God, and he does not want his people to be destroyed through guilt because they've done some foolish something and can't seem to get over it. Now, sometimes they think that we haven't been forgiven. Other times, they don't do what God asks because they try to forgive themselves, and they can't. We've all done it, tried to forgive ourselves, and why would we do that? So we don't have to fess up to God. We just tell it to ourselves, and therefore we're not guilty any longer, and God can't condemn us because we fessed up to ourselves. We tried to forgive ourselves, but we cannot forgive ourselves. We can talk to God and ask him to forgive us, and he said he would if we do ask him. Sometimes we just don't forgive ourselves. There are those who are still suffering because they just can't seem to forgive themselves. As righteous as I am and was, how could I have done that? So they can't forgive themselves because they knew better, and they did it anyway. If we are Christians, and we are, we should then take the guilt to God and ask God to forgive. Judah took his guilt to who he thought was my Lord in Egypt and didn't know he was talking to the boy he sent off to be killed. He didn't ask God for it necessarily, but he was trying to ask for forgiveness of that individual. But the ultimate place to go is to God and to ask for, to openly acknowledge it and say, please don't hold that against me anymore. Please don't hold that against me again. So we ask for forgiveness, and we may ask God for the attitude of repentance in life. Let's look in Hebrews 4, verse 14, where it is talking about this throne of grace or the mercy seat, which Israel had the knowledge of all along. That is, it was in the book, the pages they had. Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 14 says, seeing that we have a great high priest who's passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. Now, that could be confessing he is the Son of God or confessing the truth, and it could also mean confessing the things we've done. He said, why should we do this? Well, you know, we don't do it to people. Say, oh, no, I'm not going to tell him because he'll tell everybody else, and it'll be all over the place when I tell him or her. So we're not going to tell him anything. But when you go to God, he is not going to tell anybody. Well, maybe I shouldn't say that, because he did tell the world about David. You know, we say that when God forgives, he forgets. Well, how can that be true if he forgave David and then he wrote what David did in the Bible so the whole world can see it? That'll keep David humble forever, because he'll have to face those people. But the point is, God forgives and he doesn't hold it against us. So it said, we don't have a high priest that can't sympathize with us, our weaknesses, because he was tempted or tested. Satan didn't entice him. He tried to, but he didn't succeed. Then it said in verse 16, let us therefore come boldly to the throne of grace. So we just read where the throne of grace is. It's above the law. It's in the ark, shall we say, of the covenant or agreement we made with God. And God is dwelling on that throne of grace between the cherubim. And he will, as it said, I will speak to you there. I will deal with you there. When we come and confess that we've broken the laws and that we don't want to have to pay that penalty any longer, he said, I will dwell with you and you will be forgiven. Come boldly, and that doesn't mean shouting or anything, confidently. Come confidently with faith to the throne of grace that we may obtain mercy and grace to help in time of need. I think there's one that would mean an awful lot. It kind of sums up the whole process in 1 John 2. I imagine John had a lot of experience in this. He was upwards of 90, 95, 100 years old. Who knows exactly? But he was an old man. And he had seen the good, the bad, and the ugly. He had seen Judah betray Jesus. He had seen what Peter did. He realized he and his brother had asked for the two top places to get ahead of the brothers. So John had his own difficulties he had to deal with. So he had seen an awful lot, and you'll find that he said in 1 John 2, first verse, my little children. So he was a lot older than they, and he was teaching them things they didn't know fully. These things I write to you so that you may not sin or bring guilt on yourself. If anyone sins, we have an advocate with the Father, Jesus the Christ. And it says, He himself is the payment for our sins, and not for ours only, but also for the whole world. So we have confidence in that. When we come confidently before God, we know that he will forgive us. As I said before in the beginning, guilt can be absolutely devastating and may cause us, because we are distraught, cause us or goad us into doing something else that's just as bad, whether it's real or imagined. So I hope that this sermon message about guilt as a result of doing something wrong, sinning, and you grieve over it, but you don't ever confess it and go to God. That didn't mean you have to tell anybody else necessarily, but you do go to God and ask him, please don't hold that against me any longer, because I'm sorry for it, and to my knowledge, I am not going to the best of my ability, I am not going to ever do that again. And we can have confidence that he will not hold it against us, because he said in Exodus 25, above the mercy seat, come there, I'll meet you there, and we'll have a talk.